Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. ABC News reports that underground cannabis is 35.8 billion, billion with a B, annual revenues already exceed the combined value of corn and wheat. Imagine if the American economy benefited from those numbers instead of them going into criminal drug gang bank accounts. Yet the vast majority of U.S. politicians of both parties won't even talk about ending the 40-year, trillion-dollar drug war you have been financing to almost no effect since 1971. Doug Fine's book, Too High to Fail, is not simply a book of history, argument, and data, but he moved his family to Mendocino, California, to live for a year among those who, at least at the time, were living a new model of agriculture, economy, and law enforcement. Welcome, Doug Fine.
Thank you so much for having me, Terrence.
Well, you're very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Could you briefly talk about your path to the work that you do? Your life and your writing really intertwine, don't they?
They do. To my mind, it's something of a progression. Grew up in the East Coast suburbs, so I really kind of got a sense of maximum consumerism in the 1980s. Growing up, and then lived in Alaska for quite a long time to see if I could survive without box stores. Then for my second book, I wrote about living without petroleum, which I still do. I mean, we're talking via, you know, solar charged ranch here in New Mexico now. And from there, I saw the $1 trillion you're talking about, 40 years worth of misspending of money in the war on drugs. And I wanted to investigate not just the problem, everybody knows the problem, but what was there a solution? So I looked for a place where a drug peace had already been declared.
Mm-hmm. And you cite actually a personal friend, I believe, in New Mexico, who your experience of his experience with taking marijuana cannabis as a medicine was also an inspiration and pushed you forward.
Yeah, it was coming from all angles. On the one side, I was seeing the plant help people that I knew. On the other side, you know, living in America, I recognized cannabis itself as a less dangerous plant than alcohol. And then I'm right on the border, so we have these crazy events here. I had a neighbor, a retiree, who got raided in this multi-million dollar raid. You know, it's a quiet ranch here I live on where hummingbirds will actually wake me up in the morning. And one day I'm in the final scene out of Goodfellas, helicopters, planes, 50 white SUVs at a neighboring ranch. This guy who, you know, some disgruntled, you know, friend ratted on him, and all this billions of dollars in drug war money went for these 13 plants. He didn't spend a minute in jail. Not that he should have. A few months later, the mayor of a nearby town, this is a U.S. town, gets arrested as a cartel member, a drug supplier for cartels south of the border. So I saw wrong targets, misspent drug money, and I just, you know, I had to do something about it journalistically.
Okay, and what did you hope to accomplish with the book? And what I'm asking here, Doug, is two questions, sort of. The one is what you thought going in, and then how your thinking evolved during the course of research and writing.
So that's a great question. Going in, I was aware that there were a few places, and I chose one, Mendocino, California, where local communities had come together, and that's everybody, politicians, law enforcement, and citizens, to say, we're unilaterally declaring a drug peace. It pretty much has to happen in states that are medical states. We now have 17 medical states, 15 states decriminalizing our cannabis law, and both of those are growing as polls supporting this keep growing. But Mendocino, California was the one I chose because, as you mentioned in that an earlier question, sustainability is now in me. You know, if I'm living without petroleum, I have to report on a sustainable agricultural crop. Mendocino County not only decided to end its fiscal problems by permitting cannabis in what was called colloquially the zip tie program, but they also wrote in sustainability guidelines. So the local groups that were growing were all, you know, doing their own kind of fair trade and organic certification on their cannabis crop. So it was the ideal place, I thought, to investigate what that impact might be economically if the drug war were to end nationwide.
And as you point out, Mendocino, and I'd like, again, I'm gonna, as I ask these questions, they all in my head turn out to be two-part questions. Describe a little bit what Mendocino had developed in terms of the, if you will, the normalcy of it, but also what has happened to that program since you began to explore it.
Right. So Mendocino County had in place three generations of an economy. It is a cannabis economy. It's probably about 80% of the economy. It's estimated conservatively that the crop brings in $6 billion to this poor, on paper, Northern California coastal community. And the largest legal crop, grapes, brings in $74 million. So if you're a 4-H farmer about to start your career, which would you choose? So local authorities recognized it. The sheriff, I thought, put it colorfully, saying that, you know, when 1996, when California voters approved medical cannabis, he had an astounding revelation. He woke up and there was still an America. There was still 4th of July barbecues and the communists hadn't taken over. So given that it was the entire economy, essentially, or the vast majority of it, why not admit it and permit it? And that's what they did, and that's what they had in place going in. What happened was it was extremely successful. In 2011, 100 farmers came forward, paid about $8,500 in permitting fees, raised $600,000+ for the county, directly saving 7 sheriff deputy jobs that had been slated for the chopping block. And it worked so well that several surrounding counties were considering doing it, strongly considering, taking steps towards implementing a similar zip-tie program. And right before harvest, DEA agents came, in his words, machine gun blazing, to the sort of poster child for the program, the zip-tie program, you know, dawn, 5:30 a.m., busted down the door, kept, his name's Matt Cohen, kept his, he and his wife separated, in handcuffs all day with no access to lawyers for about 8 or so, 8, 9 hours, chopped down their crop, about $1 million towards their nonprofit collective, including, a cancer patient, named Bill Harney, who I followed. Who claims that that crop was keeping him alive, and helped him, get his appetite back following chemotherapy. So, they raided the poster child, in other words, not the cartel, and then followed up a few weeks later by personally threatening, that was DEA, then it was U.S. Attorney, personally threatening the Board of Supervisors that passed this sensible, patriotic, America helping, community crime decreasing, revenue generating law. Personally threatened them with federal drug conspiracy, and so they canceled the program at the end of the 2011 season. Guess what? Mendocino farmers still growing just as much cannabis, only now America's tax base doesn't benefit.
Yeah, and that number you gave was amazing, that just within Mendocino, just the fee that each farmer paid amounted to over $500,000 for Mendocino County.
Not only that, it was just the start. It was only 100 farmers. There's thousands of farmers in
right.
Mendocino County.
Right, and that isn't even talking about taxes on the production and sale. That was merely getting their local permits.
Exactly.
At a time when everyone knows California cities are going bankrupt, and the ones who aren't going bankrupt are avoiding that by cutting vital services. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Doug Fine about his book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. To learn more, go to DougFine.com. You start the book with an introductory position paper. I really liked that, and I'd like you just, you've probably done this a million times, you can probably do it in your sleep, but go over some of the numbers, Doug, to just, you know, as I say, your book is not a book of data, but the data is impressive.
So numbers in terms of what's going on with the drug war?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the whatever, I mean, what I thought about, I thought, do I want to get specific? I said, no, the ones that jump out at you. How much we've spent, how much we lose, how much we could be, you know, just whatever. Cause then, you know, then we'll ask the question of why in the face of all that does nothing happen? But for right now, just what are the most, you know, outrageous numbers you found?
Well, first of all, you mentioned in the intro, cannabis is America's number one cash crop by far already. And when it carries a risk with, you know, every plant planted, it's already by far the biggest crop in our nation. The 40-year drug war has spent about $1 trillion tax dollars to almost no effect on supply and demand. Some studies have 70% of cartel profits coming from cannabis. That was a surprise to me. The worldwide industrial cannabis industry is taking off, and we're restricting American progress in that category in places like the Heartland, North Dakota's type places, in Nebraska that could be growing, for one thing, a biofuel that has 10 times the bioefficiency per acre of corn and soy for ethanol. In other words, we could be weaning off of petroleum.
I have to cut in. I mean, if there's any crop that America should be leading the world in, it's this one.
And we used to, of course.
We used to.
So, and that's just industrial. That's, you know, that's nobody smoking anything. And it's so the insanity of the drug war can be seen there. Industrial cannabis market is growing something like 25% per year. I know all the products that my family uses and things like soaps and healthy omega balance hemp seed oil and hemp twine are several thousand dollars a year going to foreign grown cannabis. So the other thing is that we're not even getting into things like tax revenue and savings if we redirected the $9 billion that is geared in the 2013 budget just to domestic drug enforcement. Whenever you hear the drug lawyers say, "We're not fighting a drug war anymore, we're focusing on education," go, "Really? How about the highest amount ever for 2013 spent on domestic enforcement, including the approval, the federal approval of drones to fight on American soil, a drug war that shouldn't be being fought."
Oh, yeah. Now, and one other thing I want you to point out, you were talking about non-medicinal or non-recreational uses of cannabis. America really, you go to an American history book, a panorama of American history, and cannabis is there. As you point out, it's the canvas that covers the covered wagons. The Declaration of Independence, the draft that Jefferson wrote, was written on hemp parchment. Not only that, you point out that it is a much more sustainable, less water-intensive crop than soybeans and corn, which are huge crops that we feed to grazing animals, another unsustainable industry.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there really isn't a downside to ending the war on cannabis unless you are a drug attorney on either side or a member of the incarceration industry.
Right, that's what I was going to say. As I've said for years, and you point out, always follow the money. So despite those numbers that we were just citing, and as I say, this introductory position paper goes on more and more, it becomes like you just want to scream. Not that there are too many numbers, but why is this war going on? Tell us some of the numbers on the other side. What explains the fact that the D.C. Beltway is not only not moving, but treating it like a third rail? What are the industries that have their attention and perhaps their cojones?
Well, the less conspiratorial answer is that it's bureaucratic inertia. When one of the most telling things to me when the hostilities were started after 9/11 attacks were the documentaries about what the, you know, the sort of the party that all the contractors were having and hiring, and it was a great economy. War was a great economy for people who make everything from cheeseburgers to airplane parts, and that's no bearing on whether a war is quote right or quote wrong. It just is good for certain kind of economies, and that's no less true in the drug war. And what this is about is the industries that incarcerate people. Private prison industries are making very interesting pitches to municipalities, promising that they will undercut the cost per prisoner that the municipality charge, you know, has to pay doing it themselves, which sounds really nice. But on the other hand, you have to guarantee us a 97% incarceration, you know, fill up rate in our prisons. And it's like, wait a second. So that means that there has to be this continual meat grinder of poor kids going through for nonviolent so-called drug offenses, meanwhile enriching the cartel. So incarceration industry, especially private prisons, is a big one. One debate I kind of would like to be in the fly on the wall about is the pharmaceutical one as well, because, you know, I can't right now promise you that I haven't seen the emails, that there are pharmaceutical company executives involved in this that are trying to make sure that it happens at the pace, that is, the decriminalization of cannabis at the pace that they want, and probably in what I call in the book some kind of half-assed way, where there's patents issued to a few companies for a few extracts of a few cannabinoids, which simply does not work. We've been co-evolving with this plan for 10,000 years, and the broad profile of the entire plan is what needs to be available to Americans.
Yeah, and if people didn't get that, we've talked about herbal supplements on this show many times over the years. The pharmaceutical industry thrives on patentable compounds, patentable substances, and the problem with nature and all the wonderful things that nature has supplied us is that they're not patentable. So what they do is they extract a piece. But the fact is that the way they evolve in nature, as Doug pointed out, is that it's the whole plant, the whole substance and so on that really has the wonderful effects. I mentioned in the intro today that the LA City Council's vote last week to ban medical marijuana dispensaries within city limits. I'm now going to bring into the conversation Don Duncan. He's California Director of Americans for Safe Access, to give us a bit of expert opinion on what happened and what it means. Stay with us, Doug Fine. You can learn more about their work at safeaccessnow.org. Welcome, Don Duncan.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, what happened in the city council, and how much of a surprise was this? I have usually received email alerts saying, you know, it looks like there's a vote imminent. I didn't get that one on this one.
Well, it wasn't completely a surprise for us. You know, we've been working up to this moment really since 2005, when Americans for Safe Access first engaged the city on this topic. And people often ask me, you know, can we stop the ban? And I would tell them, well, we've been stopping the ban since 2005. And our city attorney, our former city attorney, Mr. Doug Adeo, and now our current city attorney, Mr. Chanich, have been determined to ban medical marijuana facilities in the city of Los Angeles all along. And so it's been an ongoing battle.
Let me jump in because we have so little time. What does this mean in practical terms as of today, as of a week from now, as of a month from now?
Well, the ordinance is going to take effect about 45 days after it was adopted. And so if it does take effect, all of the collectives and cooperatives in the city have to close. And that doesn't just mean the bad ones or the ones people don't want in their neighborhood. That means every single facility in the city of Los Angeles will have to close. And that's an unacceptable outcome. And so Americans for Safe Access has joined a coalition with organized labor and other groups and patients to file a voter referendum to repeal this ban, so that we have a chance to go back to the city council and adopt an ordinance that does work for legitimate patients and legal collectives and cooperatives.
And is there a chance you'll be able to do that before that 45 days are up?
Absolutely. I am so excited and encouraged by the support, both financial and participation, from the community. I'm very confident we'll be able to get the signatures we need within the 30-day window.
And what about this other notion that they're also entertaining something that would allow the pre-moratorium dispensaries to be grandfathered in?
There was a motion adopted to that effect, and we're encouraged by that, but we simply can't wait for everything to be banned and then wait for the city council to adopt a new ordinance. It took 2.5, almost 3 years for the first ordinance to be adopted, and they really made a mess of it. So we need to take the initiative right now, repeal the ban, and maybe that will be an incentive for the council to work harder.
Okay, I'm going to make a point of information, then ask you one last question. As a point of information, no matter what happens in L.A., will not affect access in surrounding cities. In other words, West Hollywood or Santa Monica, if it has collectives, or any of the other cities around here. And so even if this ban were going to affect, there would still be dispensaries within L.A. County.
There are a handful of dispensaries in L.A. County, that's for sure. However, it's unlikely they have the capacity to serve all of the patients in Los Angeles.
And not only that, it would also mean that some patients would have to travel long distances.
Of course,
And if since they're patients, they may be taking it for debilitating conditions. That's a hardship.
Exactly. And in the Bay Area, where we've seen restrictions on a number of collectives, what you wind up with are very large collectives, and I don't think that's what the city council is looking for, big Walmarts of medical marijuana.
Exactly, because they're attacking Harborside, the Department of Justice is attacking Harborside up in Oakland for exactly that, for being
exactly
too successful. Finally, what should listeners do if they want to get involved?
We need your help and your participation. Go to AmericansForSafeAccess.org. That's AmericansForSafeAccess.org. get on our mailing list, join the organization, and participate in this campaign. We've got a meeting coming up on August 18th. You'll get all the details online there.
Okay, thank you, Don Duncan. Let me go back one last word from Doug Fine. If you would, I think we've done an injustice, as it were, to your book in talking so much about the legal ramifications, the economic ramifications. Could you say, I mean, I'm asking you to promote your own book, but tell people what the book feels like.
Well, to be totally honest, Terrence, all of my books, all of my writing is my personally investigating something that feels important to me, getting a little bit out of my comfort zone, and hopefully doing strong investigative journalism while the reader's able to laugh at my own sort of misadventures. In this case, I was pulled over under a false, under a profiling by Sonoma County Sheriff's deputies under a billboard reading Grab Some Buds, where they falsely said that my car smelled like cannabis, and it was terrific, saying, no, I don't have one, you know, bud, let alone the pounds and pounds you think are probably in there being an old truck coming through out of Mendocino. But I am writing a book about it. Do you think I could go on a ride-along with you guys? So that's what they're going to get out of the book, those kind of stories.
Very good. So, again, Doug's book is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. To learn more, go to Doug Fine, one word, DougFine.com. Don Duncan was with us from Americans for Safe Access. Go to AmericansForSafeAccess.org to learn more and to get involved. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at TE McNally at Mac.com. And for the podcast and to sign up for the podcast, you can do it both at my site or at iTunes. Finally, thank you to Doug Fine and Don Duncan. Keep up the good work.